Chris, I will send you a Clefarf Omega invite.
Okay, I'm looking forward to it.
In the future, we don't have betas, we have omegas.
This is The End User, episode 124 for Tuesday, February 19th. Tack on the cash operator. Welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I am Futurist Prime, Taylor Moore. Chris, how was your weekend?
It was good. I have a day off today, so I got to compile the show notes and the like earlier in the day. A little less stressful.
Sounds nice.
Yeah, it's nice. Definitely nice. So we've got a really full docket of news this week. Unlike last week, we kind of struggled a little bit. It is worth noting, however, that Mobile World Congress is starting on this Saturday. So I bet you next week's show is going to be pretty insane. Lots of news.
Yeah, I bet so. But ahead of Mobile World Congress, is that the one in Barcelona?
That's correct, yes.
Right. Okay, ahead of that, LG has decided to announce its new 2013 flagship phone, the Optimus G Pro. Chris, have you seen the pictures of this thing?
Yeah, it looks pretty insane. This thing is 5.5 inches, and it's got a 1080p screen. That seems pretty cool.
Yeah, so that's 440 pixels per inch. That's way above Retina. That's at about the resolution density of that Droid DNA, but then I guess this is even bigger.
Yeah, it also strikes me that the bezel is super thin from the press shots.
The front of the phone is practically all screen.
That's pretty incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, I've seen a couple, we've seen a lot of rumors that we decided not to talk about. There's been a bunch of stuff leaking out in front of Mobile World Congress happening. And so we won't talk about some of these things. We'll hit them next week. But yeah, this is one that is actually real and we actually know about, and it looks pretty darn nice. I think LG has come a very long way from their first crop of Android phones. They also had that a Windows phone at first as well.
Right, I remember that. Do they not have any current Windows phones?
Not to my knowledge, at least. The Windows Phone 8 round of devices, I'm not sure they have one. It could be that they don't have one in the United States or something like this, or I could be wrong altogether, and somebody is screaming at me right now. But they had the LG Quantum in the first round of Windows phones, and I haven't seen any Windows Phone 8 devices from them.
Right. Well, I tell you, if I was going to get an Android phone that was over 5 inches, I would probably go for this one over the Samsung Note 2 or the whatever else is out there.
See, and I don't think I can use a device that is that large.
I was just saying if I was going to.
I think I'm at my limit with the HTC 8X. That's 4.2, and I think that's as large as I'd want to get with a smartphone.
Really? That's it? I mean, it's hard to find phones that small these days.
I know. All the flagship phones are going right over top of that.
Right. All right. Well, the specs on this new Optimus phone are great, but it is, of course, going to be enormous, and we don't know much about the real-world performance. Like, we don't know how long the battery lasts, but we do know that it will be able to record video from the front and back cameras simultaneously.
Yeah, that's kind of neat. You can do some kind of immersive video thing with it or something like that. That seems kind of
right.
Cool.
So when it finally does become available to us or the blogs that we read, then we will check back and let you know if it's a phone worth buying.
Yeah, so more Android paddle phones is the way I kind of look at it.
That's a good way of looking at it.
You can go play ping pong or something.
All right. Now, but how would you look at a company who had spent decades building their own mobile browser service, and then they gave it all up and switched to WebKit, which everybody else seems to be using?
Well, I think, and obviously you're talking about Opera here. These are the people that are in the news for giving up on their own rendering engine to go with the WebKit rendering engine, just like Chrome and Safari do.
Well, not just their rendering engine, but they've also given up on their own servers that render things for you off of your own device, whether it's your computer or phone or tablet or whatever. So they've also gone ahead and bought Skyfire, which is one of their competitors in the mobile browsing market.
Yeah, I remember Skyfire was first a Windows Mobile 6 company. Windows Mobile 6 was the first platform that they were on, if I remember correctly. And you could watch, I remember you could watch Hulu on Windows Mobile 6 using Skyfire, and that being a horrible experience, but that's really functional. That's really kind of nice. It was a real browser on your tiny phone. I remember being amazed by this.
Yeah, I remember being amazed as well. I mean, they figured out how to avoid the whole flash problem that you couldn't have flash on phones. They would just take whatever flash video and convert it to a format that does work and then stream it back to you.
Yeah, and Opera has, and unconsequently also for Windows Mobile 6, had that same kind of technology where they have Opera Mini that renders everything in the cloud and then just brings it down to you. And I'll be excited to see what they do with Skyfire. I think Skyfire...
Well, Opera and Skyfire have both still been doing that, which is why I was surprised that Opera decided to buy Skyfire. I mean, I guess it's competition for them, so it sort of makes sense. But the thing is that either of these stories in themselves aren't all that interesting. But together, it clearly signals that Opera is trying to go in a little bit of a different direction, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a huge company-changing direction that they're taking, and we'll have to see if it pays off for them. I mean, their market share has traditionally been very low, although very low means, 300 million users with, you know, a handful of percent of the browser market share. So I think this is going to be a little interesting to see if they can ratchet that up a little bit.
Yeah, I would be interested to see. Obviously, some new things will be coming from them soon, and we look forward to them.
Yeah, definitely so. And I know I've said it before, I'm kind of wedded to Chrome at this point in time, but I would love for Opera to take me away from Chrome, particularly with Google owning my entire life. If they actually make a browser that I feel more comfortable in, I would love to switch.
I've always liked the idea of Opera because they focus on having a very efficient browsing experience. That's their whole point. It's efficient on your system resources. It's efficient with your time and your screen real estate. But to me, they've never been the top dog in any of those categories. So hopefully with their new transition, they will come up with something different and better, more efficient.
Definitely. I'd love to see that happen.
All right, and for our next story in what is starting to become a weekly segment, it's the end user public service announcement. Adobe Reader has been hacked, which happens all the time, but this time it's been hacked in a way that it's never been hacked before. There is a live virus that is out in the wild in PDF files, because that's what you use Adobe Reader for. But for the first time since Adobe was able to sandbox their software and make a firewall between Adobe Reader and the rest of your system, for the first time that has been broken by a real virus that is affecting people's computers. So be very careful in the near future when opening PDFs that you found on the internet, because there's no cure right now for this.
Yeah, so the usual advice applies. You know, don't go clicking on random links from unsolicited email and the like, and just don't use Adobe Reader. That's what I do. That's
probably
good
either.
Advice. I use Foxit, which is a pretty good replacement for Adobe Reader, and I think, unless you have some kind of business need for it, then if you don't need it, get rid of it. I know I've said that before in reference to security.
Yeah, you're right. That is much
well.
Better advice. Get rid of Adobe Reader.
If you don't need it. And, you know, some people do actually need it, and I understand right. that. But if you don't, now is prime time to go into your control panel and remove it.
Well, if you have a Mac, there's almost no reason to have it at all. I can't even imagine a business reason to have it, because PDF support is built right into the operating system.
Yeah, and that's actually true in Windows 8 as well. They've got a Metro PDF reader that's bundled called
Reader.
Oh, good
for you. Good for Windows 8. They've caught up. And with that, that concludes our top stories of the week, and I guess it's time to turn on the afterburners.
Yes, please do. Start us off.
All right, a couple of Apple news to start off with. First, they went ahead and dropped the prices on a couple of the MacBook Air and MacBook Pro with Retina display models. So the cheapest MacBook Airs aren't any cheaper, but the higher end, faster processor, more hard drive or solid state drive got a $100 price drop. So it starts at $1,400 for 256 gigabytes. The 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro now starts at $1,500 instead of $1,700, which changes the value proposition.
Yeah, that's substantial.
Yeah, very substantially. And in somewhat less exciting news, they have also released updated version of the premium earbuds, which I own and love, although I'm on my second pair because their previous version, which was released over 3 years ago, now has some new features which make it more long-lasting and waterproof. So when my second pair dies, maybe I'll buy this third pair and then maybe it'll last longer. I don't know. They've also released a new lightning cable that is half the length of their regular lightning cable. It's only half a meter long, but it's the same price. So I'm not sure why you would buy that.
And Sprint has turned on some LTE towers, some in the United States, in particular in the larger cities. You can follow through in our show notes, and there's a map of where the LTE is activated. They're hoping to get, quote, near nationwide LTE by the end of this year.
And Valve's Steam service has finally announced the release of Steam for Linux. So you can now download the client free, and they're having a big sale on lots of games for Linux.
I'll have to check out the client for Linux, because as I understand it, there are a ton of games that still don't work on Linux, but they're actively working on these things to make it better. So I'll have to see what is and is not there.
Okay, do that and let us know. One more thing is that Skype is now doing video messages. So if you call someone and you miss them, or I don't know how it works, I haven't tried it yet, but you can record a video message and send it to someone on Skype.
Yeah, that seems kind of cool. It seems like something they just should have had in the first place, and I guess now they do. Although it's worth noting that it's Mac and iPhone and Android only. I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, that is a little weird.
And no Windows Phone, even though it's a Microsoft product in the first place.
Well, I guess us Apple users get the new features every once in a while.
Well, and that makes sense for... I just saw another story earlier that said that I think it was 91% of the market is Android and iOS combined. So, yeah, that's not entirely surprising, right?
Right. Now, in our last Afterburner story, Google has a new home screen widget for Android, which is called the contextual search widget for Google Now. You need to update the Google search app, and then what it does is it will pull information based on a contextual search that you provide. So if you want to know the traffic on a certain road, you can just set up this little search, and then it'll send live information straight to your home screen without you doing a new search every time.
Right. So that's kind of cool. The extending Google Now and into a permanent place on the home screen, it seems like a good idea to me.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. And with that, we should turn off our afterburners.
Yeah, turn them off. We can safely continue. You can unbuckle your seatbelt or whatever it is, or unpack your gun, I think, was from last week.
Lasers, Chris. I have lasers.
Ah, lasers. Okay. Of course, if you're the Futurist Prime, so you have lasers.
Yes.
And laughing at all of us in the past for not having lasers.
Yes, but I won't laugh until the future, so don't worry.
All right, so our first story in the end user stories is that apparently Apple reintroduced their bug from a while back. I know we talked about this on the podcast, where you could invoke the emergency dialer and unlock the phone somehow. So apparently they've reintroduced this bug and they're working on a fix for it now.
Yeah, technically speaking, it's not the same bug. What it is an exploit that lets you get past a lock screen and get access to someone's contacts or, in some cases, all of their phone. But every time they come out with a new update of the operating system, someone finds a new bypass, and then they have to wait for the next version of the software to fix it. And I don't know why they keep leaving them in. I mean, it gets more and more complicated. I mean, you have to open up the emergency dialer and then close it and then press the home button twice and then hit something else. And then eventually you get unrestricted access to the phone, which is terrible. But, like, how did they miss something that, like, I don't even understand how it would be there by accident?
I don't know. You'd really have to see how the code was functioning to understand why this bug was in existence. But it is kind of curious. It points to some kind of flaw in their QA. And I got to think that they'll shore this up now, especially that they've reintroduced this.
Yeah, I'm sure that they will. And they always do whenever this thing comes out. But the point is, it shouldn't keep coming out.
Yeah, definitely not. So I'll certainly be hoping that this is not happening in the future once they fix this. This should be the last time we hear of this, and if it's not, then shame on Apple.
Right.
But true. That's also my anticipation, is that this is the last time we'll hear of this kind of thing.
I hope so.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about, and we've had these details for a while, but the consumer versions of Office are now out, and you can buy them. And I thought it would be kind of interesting to dig into the prices and what this means for the end user. And we didn't really talk about this because we had some more pressing news in the past. Because honestly, Office is a little bit boring to talk about. The new versions are very nice, though. The whole idea of this switch is to encourage people to subscribe instead of buy the standalone versions of Office. So the home and student version, which is the most likely the end user would buy, is going to be $140, and you get one license to install on one machine. And in comparison, if you get the Office 365 Home Premium package, that's $100 a year subscription, and you get five licenses. And the licenses are locked to the PC in which you install them, so it's quite a bit less flexible than the days of old. I know that I've installed Office after like reinstalling Windows and stuff like that many times, and I don't know. I think it's kind of interesting. What do you think? Are you looking forward to getting a subscription, or is that nonsense? What do you think?
It's nonsense, and I don't think it applies to Mac users. In fact, they made some other changes, which we're just learning about. Microsoft may have made these changes as early as September, but people only started noticing recently. But the Office for Mac, the versions that are available are the same ones that have been available for over 2 years already. They didn't update the Mac version, but they did go ahead and raise the price by $20. So Office for Mac, the professional edition, is, even though it's more than 2 years old, it's more expensive than the full license for PC for the brand new software.
Yeah, and I didn't notice that until you brought it up. Since
nobody noticed it for several months, no one knows how long the change was made. But someone eventually noticed, and now we're talking about it.
Truly bizarre, and this is for Office 2011, right?
Yeah.
So that is truly bizarre. I do not understand why that's happening. Now, I could understand them readjusting it if they had released a 2013 version for Mac, but it's truly bizarre that they're retroactively changing this.
Yeah.
So I've yet to put Office on my Windows 8 PC. I've got a long-in-the-tooth version of 2007 waiting in the wings, and honestly, I haven't missed it. You know, I've what I have been doing in Office previously, I am doing in Google Docs. And I think that now that I'm out of school, you know, maybe I'm not in need of Office so much. You know, I have Office at work, and I do need that, but that's work provided. So they get to worry about it, and they get to look at the professional subscription license options. But for the end user, Office is becoming less and less of a requirement these days. So I definitely couldn't justify dropping $140 for the standalone version. Now, I don't know about the $100 a year. I figure if I run into a need at some point, I will probably drop it at that point in time. But there's no point in sinking into a subscription up front without gaining any benefit to the subscription.
That seems reasonable enough. I mean, why do it now if you don't need it now?
Yeah, especially for a subscription. I mean, if this was a one-off software purchase, then the clock is not ticking, right? So, but if it's a subscription, I'm going to apply that subscription mentality to it, right?
So Microsoft must have planned for this. They must assume that there is a part of their loyal customer base that is not going to buy the new version right now because it would be cheaper to get the subscription version, but they don't need the subscription version yet. And so they must be planning to either get more money off of the people that are buying the professional licenses or by people that keep renewing the subscription year after year.
Yeah, I think that's entirely reasonable in that they're looking to make up some of the difference off of business in some way. Businesses are, by and large, very dependent upon Exchange and very dependent upon Office, the Office suite, including Outlook. So I think that kind of makes sense. And I'm not so sure, depending on what kind of person you are, if this subscription makes sense for you.
All right. Well, let's say that you're the type of person who knows you need Microsoft Office on your new PC and you're going to need it for the foreseeable future. Do you think that person should get the full license or the subscription?
Probably the subscription. I don't see a use case for the home and student one-off retail license.
I mean, what if you're going to use it for 2 years?
Yeah, I mean, but then you get, so when they come out with updates, you get the most recent version no matter what. If you really wanted to stand still like that, then maybe, but I really think that the subscription is the way to go. So you get, assuming you have one laptop across 2 years and that's all you intend upon doing, then that's fine. But for the $100 a year, you get five PCs. So I would be hard-pressed to find a situation where the one-off purchase would make sense.
You have one laptop. You don't know how long you're going to use it, but you're only going to use it for that one laptop. You're not planning on reinstalling Windows anytime soon.
Yeah, see, it's pretty narrow.
Which one is it now?
Yeah, it's a pretty narrow set of circumstances, isn't it?
That doesn't sound very narrow to me. That sounds like most consumers.
Yeah, you think so?
Yeah.
All right, well, and they're also, we're still kind of waiting on them to announce what they're going to do with mobile devices. Office for iPad has been rumored, and it'll be interesting to see. They've got some language in there that suggests that they're going to release Office for more devices, and it'll be interesting. Yeah, and Rennie in there in the chat is mentioning that the license that you get for Office 2013 can only be activated once. So if you reinstall Windows, like you mentioned, Taylor, then your license will be invalidated. Although I bet you, I get the feeling, and this is something that's still unanswered in my mind, if you call customer service, they'll have some kind of robot like they do for Windows. So they have this cap for Windows where if you go over the install limit, which I did, then you have to go through this extra validation process. And they seem to be pretty liberal with allowing you to continue. So I have to wonder if that is actually going to be the case if we run into this situation. But yeah, officially the word is that you can only activate it once on one machine and then that's it.
Well, I look forward to someone testing this and seeing if it's possible to do it more than once because that just seems ridiculous.
It's early days, so I'm sure people will start to run into this cap, and it'll be interesting to see how we adjust to this. But yeah, Microsoft's making moves. Windows 8, Office licensing changes. I mean, they're changing their business.
Yeah, they're making their pricing structure even more complicated than it used to be. If I was looking for Office 365 or Office 2013, I'd have to make a spreadsheet. I couldn't decide on my own.
Well, let me put it this way. I think if it takes us 20 minutes to run down the versions of Office and how they're different from the past, your licensing structure is too complicated. Isn't that true?
That is very true. All I've been trying to say the whole time is to get you to say that their licensing structure is too complicated.
Their licensing structure is too complicated.
Okay. Microsoft, you heard it on the end user. You need to fix it.
Yeah, definitely so. I definitely agree with that.
Okay. So should we move on to our next story?
Yes, please do. Enough of Office. We're done there.
Okay. So today I want to talk about a Federal Communications Commission report called Measuring Broadband America. They release this every year, and we've never talked about it before because it's not very interesting. But this year they did one interesting thing. They included satellite broadband providers.
Ooh, satellite. Are there
satellite, yeah.
Are there satellite providers around here?
They're everywhere, Chris. They're in space.
They're in space.
Well, so they're located in geosynchronous orbit above North America. So it's not everywhere. You have to have a clear line of sight to a particular angle in the sky, which changes depending on where in the country you are. But as we mentioned a while ago, the conglomeration of satellite companies has been launching next generation broadband satellites. So they now have a total satellite bandwidth of 140 gigabits per second. Right, and so for consumers,
distributed across many people, right?
Yeah, it's distributed across many people. So for consumers, they advertise an average of 12 megabits per second down, 3 megabits per second up. Because they have a limited total bandwidth, they do institute data caps for users, which are based on your usage for the time of day in the month. And they probably shouldn't do that because it's ridiculous, but that's how it works. But they have been able to provide 130% of advertised speeds on average.
Right, so they're under-predicting themselves, unlike many of the other cable companies and the like.
Yeah, by more than anybody else. Upload speeds were 160% of advertised. So you pay for three and you get five, basically. Anyway, the main problem with satellite service is latency. So the time it takes for a signal to go from your computer to a server and back takes, on average, for most broadband providers, it takes an average of 29.6 milliseconds. For satellite, it is 20 times slower than that. It is the better part of 1 second.
Right. So that means things that are dependent upon time, like gaming, it's not a good application for that.
Yeah. Gaming and voice chat, basically.
Right. Let alone doing a podcast like this.
Oh, yeah. Couldn't do it.
Yeah. We'd talk over each other all the time. We already do talk over each other, but it would be even worse.
Well, anyway, the point is the FCC has released this report. They've included satellite internet, which is, despite its drawbacks, for many people, one of the only viable broadband options. And in most of those cases, it is now the best option. So that was it. That's all I wanted to say.
Cool. So we've got another story here. The HBO is letting some of their content free. They're releasing it into the wild.
Yeah, so they announced this past week that they are bringing HBO Go to the Apple TV. They will eventually have a channel sometime this year. But in the meantime, they've updated their HBO Go and Max Go apps, because HBO owns Cinemax. I don't know if you knew that, to allow users to stream video from an iPhone or an iPad to an Apple TV. Previously, they blocked that feature, you would actually get a message on your screen saying, this service does not allow AirPlay streaming. Now they've gone ahead and added it in, which is really great for someone like me. I pay for HBO Access primarily just to have HBO Go. We don't have access to the actual live HBO stream on our TV because we haven't bothered hooking up a cable box. But now we can watch live HD well, not live, but streaming HD, HBO on our TV, so which we're paying for, which is great.
He also mentions in this interview from All Things D, the Xbox and Roku already have an app, and they're trying to get on the Apple TV. And yeah, as an interim, like you mentioned, that you can do the AirPlay mirroring dance. So that seems like a small step in the right direction, huh?
Yeah, it's a small step with another big step coming for Apple users anyway who have HBO. And I've been using this all week, and it's been great. I mean, HBO Go has a lot of movies in addition to their shows that, I mean, I don't mind watching, you know, some of HBO's shows on my iPad, but I don't want to watch a full-length movie there if I could watch it on my TV. And now I can. It's great.
Definitely. So go check it out if you have HBO Go and an iPad. Let us know how it goes.
And with that, I want to get into my green tech story of the week.
Right, it's like the quasi-green tech story.
Yeah, it's a quasi-green tech story. It's also sort of a meta-green tech story. Some of our listeners may be familiar with a review of the new, well, not so new, but the Tesla Model S, a new review by the New York Times. One of their reporters drove the Model S around northeast United States, and it happened to be a particularly cold day, and the reporter did not have a great experience. So he sort of panned the car. What he said essentially was that in many cases, the car overestimated its ability to reach the next charging station. He was using a series of interstate super fast charger mechanisms that he ended up having a lot of trouble finding, and his car died completely once, and he had to get it towed.
So what came on the heels of this is the founder of the company that makes the Tesla actually responded to him, and they've been having this public battle of sorts, and I don't really want to get into the drama of it, but what they've been saying is basically he tried to use it and he had a poor experience and he did some things wrong, and all of these things combined to have a dead battery on a car. And it also says that a CNN reporter actually completed this. So it's not impossible, but some things definitely went wrong. And I think he had a real life experience with it, even though maybe he did some things incorrectly. I think it's kind of interesting that electric cars aren't quite foolproof yet. I think that's what I would take away from it. And we need to have charging stations at smaller intervals. We haven't quite gotten there yet.
When I first read the New York Times article, I did think the same thing that you were thinking, was that he had a real life experience with it, and things just went wrong. And sometimes, you know, regular gasoline cars go wrong, and you need to get them towed. And you less frequently run out of fuel with those, but it's because most drivers are used to taking into account how much gas they need.
Right.
And gas stations are not that hard to find. Then when I read Elon Musk's response to the article, it sounded like this guy had a chip on his shoulder and just wanted to pan electric cars and was reporting things inaccurately, because Tesla had installed a special diagnostic system of instruments which they could read and compare to the reporter's article, in which he reports certain statistics. The reporter, however, responded to Elon Musk's response and pointed out that he was basically on the phone with Tesla representatives in New York, Boston, and California almost the entire time he was on the road trip. And so now I'm not quite sure what to think, but I do know that his experience does not replicate a regular driver's experience.
Okay, interesting.
So I just wanted to cover my broad strokes of that. If you are not interested in the ins and outs of reviewing a Tesla Model S, I'm sorry. If you've read the whole thing, then now you have my take, but I don't think I need to say much more.
Yeah, if you read every word of this back and forth, it would be some kind of novel of some sort. So let's get on.
Well, I've been trying to wrap my head around it.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to kind of digest all of what's happening between them. So anyway, let's ditch the drama and let's get into our tip of the week. As usual, you were able to find us a good one. What you got?
All right. So this is barely even a tip, I think, but many times you are looking for an older version of a website or someone's pulled a website, and you can often get those websites, their backed up version from Google's cache. And these are usually pretty easily available in search results, but you can search directly for cached versions of web pages just by using a search operator. And that is, you just type cache, C-A-C-H-E, colon. And then search for whatever it was you were going to search for. And then you can get the cached version of whatever website that you find.
Nice. So if something goes down, for whatever reason, high traffic or whatever it is, you can just tack on the cache operator and it'll find the Google cache version, and you can find the website anyway. So that's pretty cool.
Tack on the cache operator.
Yeah. That should be like a saying of some sort. All right, so let's move on to our app pick, and we've got one more story after that to go. So this one is also from you, so I'll let you take it.
All right. This app pick for this week is just about every Android app on Windows 8.
Nice. So this is the Intel version of Windows 8.
Right. It can't be Windows RT. It has to be the 8. Apparently, it's currently optimized only for the Surface Pro. But it should work in theory with any full Windows 8 machine. This is an emulator called BlueStacks that runs Android apps.
That's
such
the
as Angry
image
Birds.
They have in the article there. So
yeah, Android apps such as Angry Birds or anything else, and you can run them on the Surface Pro or any other Windows 8 device. Although it would obviously help if that device had touchscreen.
Yeah, definitely so. And I think particularly given the form factor of the Surface Pro, this seems like a fantastic idea. And I'd be eager to try this out. I'll put it on my desktop and see what happens. But I can't imagine those touchscreen apps being terribly useful because they're not really optimized for that kind of input. But it looks like they have a Windows 7 version and a Windows 8 version and a Mac beta right now. Cool.
Oh, cool.
So, Taylor, you'll have to try the Mac beta and see what's going on there.
Yeah, I will.
All right, into our last story of the night, the Pirate Bay sues itself. Or at least that's what you said in the pre-show. What is this all about?
No, they're not suing themselves. I mean, the Pirate Bay suing anyone, particularly for copyright infringement, is just kicker-worthy material right there. But who they are suing is a parody site that's making fun of the Pirate Bay. And so the parody Pirate Bay site is being sued by the Pirate Bay, the company and website most famously known for parody and copyright infringement.
Yeah, they're just off there in left field being crazy. I can't imagine them doing this, but I guess if they have the right moral reason to do it, then they feel like they should do it. So
it's all right.
Very interesting.
Well, here's how and why it happened. The Pirate Bay is nominally based in Sweden. I don't think they're in Sweden anymore. They've been kicked out.
That's right.
But they're run by mostly Swedish people, as far as I understand it. A Finnish group called the Copyright Information and Anti-Piracy Center set up a site that was essentially the Finnish word for Pirate Bay. So since this is a Finnish site that supports copyright claims on the internet and goes directly against the goals of the Pirate Bay themselves, they are suing this anti-piracy group.
Oh, yeah, I see what they did. So I just went through on the link there, and you go through and you type something. They've got this parody site, and you go through the link, and you click search. And then it says, let's see. It says, oh, you got lucky. you're just a few clicks away and totally legal. So that must have rubbed them the wrong way.
Right. So the Pirate Bay was unhappy about this, and they have publicly stated that they filed a police report for the copyright claim, quote, because we enjoy being a pain in the ass of the copyright lobby.
Of course.
End quote.
Those guys are a bunch of cowboys, is what that means.
Right. Yeah. And, well, they're just trying to play the copyright lobby at their own game.
Yeah, exactly right. All right, so I think that'll do it for this week. Mr. Futurist Prime, if someone were to try to send you a message on Twitter that is less than 140 characters using the Chrome browser, where would they type 140 characters into to get at you?
I don't know. In the future, we don't have Chrome or Twitter. We have these things called Blurp and Klfarf.
So what's your Klfarf handle?
Well, you wouldn't be able to send me a message on Klfarf now, would you? But if you wanted to get at me in the present, I guess Twitter is a pretty good way to do it. It is one of the most futuristic services that I use in the present, in 2013. So on Twitter, I am at TaylorPhone.
So on Twitter in the past, you are at TaylorPhone. Is this correct?
In my past, in your present, yes.
Right, exactly right. Okay, and if you wanted to get at me, I'm at Chris Hale Barnes. So,
and together, we are at The End User.
That's correct.
THENDUSR.
So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, at thedigitalmediazone.com under The End User. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts that you can listen to. Have a look for Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, and the Movie Podcast. You can send us some feedback via email. We are theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com. Or you can ping us on Twitter with that address that Taylor just gave you. It's @theenduser. You can join us live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Taylor Marr.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Chris, I will send you a Klfarf Omega invite.
Okay. I'm looking forward to it.
In the future, we don't have betas. We have omegas.